Buying bread from a man in Brussels, he was 6'4" and full of muscle. I said, "Do you speak my language?" He just smiled and gave me a Vegemite sandwich. So goes one of the most iconic verses from Australian rock band Men at Work's 1981 international smash hit Down Under, chronicling the travels of an Australian man and the colourful characters he meets around the world. The song has become something of an unofficial anthem for the land of Oz, perhaps more so than Waltzing Matilda or the actual national anthem, Advance Australia Fair. As no to all things Aussie, the song naturally includes a reference to that most quintessentially Australian of foodstuffs, Vegemite, a dark brown sticky spread with the consistency of used motor oil and a uniquely pungent, salty, savoury flavour described as somewhere between beef and soy sauce. For over 100 years, Vegemite has been a cornerstone of Australian culture, with over 22 million jars being produced every year and around 80% of Australian households having at least one jar in their pantries. But what is Vegemite anyway? What is it made of? Who invented it? And how did such a bizarre product come to be such a beloved symbol of the land down under? Well, grab your slouch hat and boomerang and fire up your ute as we dive into the surprisingly long and fascinating history of Australia's strange and beloved snack. While Vegemite, as we know it today, first appeared on Australian store shelves in 1923, to understand its origins, we must first travel 80 years into the past and 15,000 kilometres away to mid-19th century Germany. Our story begins in 1847 with the legendary German chemist Justus Freiherr von Liebig, perhaps best remembered today for his contributions to organic chemistry and for inventing the von Liebig condenser, a distillation apparatus still found in chemistry laboratories around the world. In 1815, when von Liebig was just 12 years old, the eruption of Mount Tambora in Indonesia launched vast quantities of volcanic ash into the atmosphere, triggering a significant drop in global temperatures. The resulting year without summer was marked by widespread crop failures and famines that killed an estimated 100,000 people worldwide. This event had a profound impact on von Liebig, who would devote much of his career to improving crop science and global nutrition. For example, in 1840, he determined that the growth of plants is dependent on five chemical elements: nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, hydrogen, and carbon. While the latter two are extracted from air and water, the rest must be drawn from the soil and can be supplemented through the use of fertilizers such as livestock manure and bird droppings, aka guano. This monumental discovery would later lead to the development of chemical fertilizers, which significantly boosted crop yields and allowed billions more people around the world to be fed. In 1947, von Liebig developed a process for producing cheap, nutritious meat extract that he dubbed Extractum Carnis Liebig. This process involved trimming unwanted fat from choice cuts of meat, grinding it, mixing it with water, and then boiling down this mixture to produce a thick paste. Von Liebig hoped his extract would help supplement the diet of those too poor to afford regular meat, but unfortunately, the limited supply of cattle and other livestock in Europe made this plan uneconomical. Von Liebig thus openly published the details of his process, writing that, quote, "the benefit of it should be placed at the command of as large a number of persons as possible by the extension of the manufacture, and consequently a reduction in the cost." But it would be another decade and a half before the great chemist's dream finally became a reality. In 1862, German railway engineer George Christian Gebert, along with von Liebig and a group of investors, founded the Société de Freibentos Gebert and Compagnie and constructed a pilot beef extract plant in the town of Villa Independencia in Uruguay, later renamed Freibentos. These being the days before refrigerated ships and rail cars or large-scale meat canning, cattle in South America were largely slaughtered for their leather, producing a large surplus of cheap meat and allowing Extractum Carnis Liebig to be produced at one-third the cost of in Europe. This venture was immediately successful, with nearly 28,000 kilograms of the extract being sold in 1864. The following year, von Liebig assumed the directorship of the firm, which was named the Liebig Extract of Meat Company, to capitalize on his famous name. Ironically, however, this marketing tactic worked a little too well, as Liebig extract of meat soon became a genericized term for this product and was used by several other companies in their marketing. Indeed, a judge ruled that the name had fallen into general use and could thus no longer be trademarked, forcing the Liebig Extract of Meat Company to change its name to the more distinctive Lemco. In 1873, Lemco established a corned beef canning operation under the name Freibentos. This too proved extraordinarily successful, especially during the Boer War of 1899-1902 and the Great War of 1914-1918, when millions of tins were supplied to the British Armed Forces as standard field rations. Freibentos soon entered the British vernacular vernacular as a generic term for corned beef and a slang word meaning very good. And in a classic example of British wartime humor, the crew of the British Mark IV tank F-41 christened their giant metal can of a vehicle, you guessed it, Frey Bentos. On August 22, 1917, during the Third Battle of Ypres, Frey Bentos trundled into action near St. Julien, Belgium, only to become stuck in the mud near the German trenches. Over the next 60 hours, the crew heroically fought off repeated German infantry attacks before escaping back to Allied lines, an action which earned them the most decorations of any tank crew of the First World War, but that's an incredible story for another video. But in any event, as a result of such massive global sales, Frey Bentos became known as the Kitchen of the World, with the town's meat processing plant expanding into one of the largest industrial complexes in all of South America. At its peak, Frey Bentos employed more than 5,000 people, processed one cow every 5 minutes. In 1899, Lemco changed the name of its flagship beef extract to OXO, a brand name still familiar to millions of households around the world today. During the 1908 Summer Olympics in London, Lemco made history by supplying British athletes with OXO to fortify them, becoming the game's first corporate sponsor. However, the cost of the original liquid formulation was still beyond the means of many families, prompting Lemco to work with English chemist Henry Enfield to develop an even cheaper version. The result was the first solid OXO bouillon cubes introduced in 1910 at a cost of only a penny each. These also proved extraordinarily popular, with over 100 million being supplied to the British Armed Forces during the First World War. In 1924, Lemco was acquired by British food conglomerate Vestey Holdings. By this time, the company had grown so successful that they were forced to expand their operations, and in 1928, they purchased a former Royal Mail power station in Southwark, London, for a conversion into a cold storage facility. Part of the redesign involved the construction of an Art Deco tower on the banks of the Thames, on which Lemco planned to mount illuminated signs advertising its products. However, these plans were rejected by the London government, Riverside Advertising being banned at the time. Instead, architect Albert Moore cheekily redesigned the tower to feature two circular and one X-shaped windows, spelling out the word OXO. Despite seriously stretching the city's rules regarding public advertising, the OXO Tower was allowed to stand, and this now iconic landmark continues to grace the London skyline to this day. In 1968, the OXO brand was bought by Anglo-Dutch multinational Unilever, who in 2001 sold it to the American Campbell Soup Company. In 2006, the UK branch was bought out by Premier Foods, which continues to produce OXO cubes and other products to this day. Despite its pioneering role and extraordinary success, Lemco was far from the only player in the burgeoning meat extract market. In 1870, during the Franco-Prussian War, French Emperor Napoleon III ordered 1 million cans of beef from Scottish-born Canadian butcher John Lawson Johnston. However, while large quantities of cheap beef were readily available from Canada and South America, canning technology had not yet been fully perfected, making it difficult for Lawson Johnston to fill Napoleon's order. He thus developed a less perishable, concentrated beef extract similar to OXO, which he dubbed Johnston's Fluid Beef. This was later changed to Bovril, a combination of the Latin bovinus, or ox, and vril, a fictional energy source from British writer Edward Bulwer-Lytton's 1871 science fiction novel Vril, The Power of the Coming Race. And if that name sounds familiar, Bulwer-Lytton is the prolific originator of such now cliched phrases as pursuit of the almighty dollar, the great unwashed masses, the pen is mightier than the sword, and the classic novel opening, it was a dark and stormy night. The more you know! Appropriately, he is the namesake of the annual tongue-in-cheek Bulwer-Lytton Fiction Contest, in which contestants compete to craft the opening sentence of the worst of all possible novels. Like OXO and Frey Bentos, Bovril quickly became a British institution, with large quantities being supplied to British forces during the Boer War and the First and Second World Wars. Mixed with hot water or even milk, Bovril is a classic hearty drink for cold weather, becoming inextricably associated with British football culture and famously sustaining Sir Ernest Shackleton and his crew during their ill-fated 1914-1917 Antarctic expedition. So famous and beloved was Bovril in the early 20th century that it holds the distinction of being one of the few products to be openly endorsed by the Pope, with Pope Leo XIII appearing in a series of advertisements along with the slogan, "The Two Infallible Powers, the Pope and Bovril." In 2001, Bovril was bought out by Unilever, who in 2004 made the controversial decision to remove the beef ingredients from the formula to make the beloved brand vegetarian. Several reasons were cited for this move, including the rise in popularity of vegetarianism and the recent mad cow disease scare, which had led to an export ban on British beef. The company also wanted to expand sales to nations like Malaysia, which has strict regulations on the import of non-halal beef products. However, following public outrage and the lifting of export bans, in 2006, Unilever reversed its decision and reintroduced the original beef-based Broville to the market. And, well, there was much rejoicing. Yet despite their beloved status in British culture, the purported nutritional benefits of OXO, Bovril, and other similar meat extracts turned out to be highly overblown. Indeed, studies conducted in the 1860s revealed that dogs fed nothing but Liebig extract of meat quickly died. As science historian Mark Finlay later wrote, "The assumption that Liebig's extract of meat was extremely nutritious came under heavy attack. Dozens of articles and analyses were published on the issue. In fact, most studies proved that Liebig's meat extract contained virtually no trace of fats, gelatins, and proteins. In brief, it lacked the very basis of meat's nutrition value." Most experts soon agreed that meat extract must be placed exceedingly low in the scale of direct or absolute nutrients. End quote. As a result, companies like Lemko and Lawson Johnson were forced to change their marketing, rebranding their products as comfort items, athletic stimulants, or easily digestible food for invalids. Indeed, by the late 1860s, St. Thomas's Hospital in London reportedly consumed 12,000 pots of Liebig extract every year. Thankfully, however, Justus von Liebig was on hand once again with an innovative solution. In the 1890s, the great chemist discovered how to make a savory and nutritious extract from an industrial byproduct far cheaper than meat, leftover brewer's yeast, aka lees. This process involved heating the yeast until the cells died and ruptured, whereupon the cells' own enzymes broke down their proteins into similar peptides and amino acids, a process known as autolysis. The resulting slurry was then centrifuged, filtered, and air-dried to form either a thick paste or dry powder, similar in consistency and flavor to OXO or Bovril. The extract's distinctive savory or umami taste derived largely from the presence of various glutamates, including monosodium glutamate, that's MSG. The first firm to exploit this discovery was the Marmite Food Extract Company, founded in 1902 in Burton-upon-Trent, Staffordshire. For its factory, the company rented a disused malt house for £100 a year, using as its raw material used yeast supplies by the nearby Bass Brewery. The name Marmite, while pronounced in English as Marmite, was derived from the French marmite, meaning cauldron or stock pot, the image of which prominently features on the Marmite label and which inspired the distinctive shape of the Marmite jar. For its first few years of operation, the Marmite Food Extract Company struggled to get off the ground. British yeast varieties and fermentation methods, it was discovered, were less well suited to the von Liebig process than their European counterparts, requiring new varieties and equipment to be imported from the continent at great expense. Furthermore, the unique and divisive taste of Marmite made it a hard sell even to a British people by now well used to beef extracts like OXO and Bovril. Nonetheless, by 1907, the company had become successful enough to warrant the construction of a second factory at Camberwell Green in South London. And in 1910, Marmite received a huge boost thanks to a major scientific breakthrough, the discovery of vitamins. For nearly two centuries, physicians and biologists had suspected that certain diseases were caused by a lack of some unknown vital factor in the sufferer's diet. For instance, sailors on long voyages typically had been ravaged by scurvy, whose symptoms include weakness, fatigue, easy bruising, bleeding gums, tooth loss, and eventually death, while in Southeast Asia, beriberi, characterized by severe weight loss, edema, lower body paralysis, and confusion, has long been endemic. In 1747, Scottish physician James Lind conducted a series of experiments demonstrating the effectiveness of citrus fruit for preventing and curing scurvy. Despite opposition from the mainstream medical community, who ascribed scurvy to a variety of other causes, the Royal Navy began issuing lemons and limes aboard its ships, resulting in British sailors, and eventually British people in general, acquiring the nickname of limeys. Unfortunately, however, this did not mark the end of scurvy in the Royal Navy, for lemons and limes were too expensive to be issued on a universal basis. Furthermore, lemon and lime juice did not keep well on long sea voyages, while boiling and concentrating it destroyed its anti-scorbutic properties. It was not until the 1770s, following experiments conducted by Captain James Cook during his first voyage to the South Pacific, that the Royal Navy discovered that pickled cabbage, aka sauerkraut, was just as if not more effective than lemons and limes at preventing scurvy, and it was much less perishable. Only when sauerkraut began to be widely issued aboard Royal Navy ships did rates of scurvy finally begin to decline. 100 years later, in 1881, Russian physician Nikolai Lunin conducted a series of experiments in which one group of laboratory mice was fed milk while another was fed a mixture of all the known constituents of milk, protein, fat, carbohydrates, and salt. The mice in the second group all died, leading Lunin to conclude that, quote, a natural food such as milk must therefore contain, besides these known principal ingredients, small quantities of unknown substances essential to life. 3 years later, physician Takaki Kanehiro of the Imperial Japanese Navy observed that while beriberi was endemic among the lower and middle classes, whose diet consisted mostly of polished white rice, the upper classes, who ate a more Western diet, were largely unaffected. He thus conducted an experiment using the crews of two battleships, one of which was fed only white rice, and the other a varied diet of meat, fish, barley, rice, and beans. By the end of the experiment, the former group suffered 161 cases of beriberi and 25 deaths, and the latter only 14 cases and no deaths. Unfortunately, the Navy misinterpreted the results and concluded that beriberi was caused by protein deficiency. As a result, the disease continued to ravage the region. It was not until 1897 that Dutch physician and physiologist Christian Eichmann, working in the Dutch East Indies, in modern-day Indonesia, discovered that feeding chickens, and later people, unpolished brown rice prevented and cured beriberi, leading him to postulate the existence of what English biochemist Frederick Hopkins later called accessory factors in the rice bran, factors that were stripped away by the polishing process. Finally, in 1910, Japanese scientist Umetaro Suzuki managed to extract and isolate this accessory factor, dubbing it beric acid. 2 years later, Polish biochemist Casimir Funk repeated Suzuki's experiments and, at the suggestion of fellow biochemist Maximilian Nierenstein, dubbed the extracted nutrient complexes vitamines, short for vital amines. Suzuki's beric acid was soon renamed thiamine, or vitamin B1, the first of the modern vitamin complexes to be discovered. Many more would follow, including retinol, or vitamin A, in 1913, and ascorbic acid, or vitamin C, the cause of the age-old scourge of scurvy, in 1920. But while Casimir Funk originally believed that all accessory factors were chemical amines, this turned out to not be the case, prompting British biochemist Jack Drummond to suggest in 1920 that the E in vitamine be dropped, creating the modern word vitamin. For their role in discovering vitamins, in 1928, Christian Eichmann and Frederick Hopkins were awarded the Nobel Prize for physiology or medicine. In the wake of these breakthroughs, it was discovered that Marmite happened to be rich in B vitamins, including thiamine, or B1, riboflavin, or B2, and B12, or cobalamin, a fact which finally endeared the product to the British people and caused sales to skyrocket. Sold as a highly nutritious superfood under the simple but effective slogan, "Good for you," Marmite was widely served in British schools and hospitals and other institutions as a dietary supplement, while millions of jars were issued to British servicemen and prisoners of war, and provided as aid to war-torn countries during both world wars in order to stave off beriberi. As one British soldier recalled, prisoners of war sometimes resorted to subterfuge to prevent their Marmite from being confiscated by camp guards. To quote, "While in prison camp, aid parcels would arrive, but our captors would supervise the unpacking of these parcels, taking anything good for themselves. When they came to Marmite, they would ask, 'What's this for?' Our reply was, 'Stuff to rub on your boots.' They would say, 'You can have,' and let them keep the Marmite." The sticky black stuff even played a vital role in a major dietary science breakthrough. In the late 1930s, English hematologist Lucy Wills traveled to Bombay, India, modern-day Mumbai, to study what was then known as pernicious anemia of pregnancy, which largely affected Indian women employed in the textile industry. Wills soon discovered that this affliction differed from a regular pernicious anemia, a lack of red blood cells caused by a deficiency of vitamin B12, which could be treated using liver extracts. Rather, it was a form of macrocytic anemia, in which the red blood cells are larger than usual. Following experiments with mice, Willis postulated the existence of an unknown Willis factor, the richest source of which he found to be yeast extracts like Marmite. In the 1940s, this factor was identified as folate, or vitamin B9, the synthetic version of which, folic acid, is now added to all sorts of food products, including wheat flour, in order to stave off macrocytic anemia in pregnant women and birth defects in children. By the 1920s, Marmite had become yet another British culinary institution, most commonly consumed by spreading it very thinly on buttered toast or adding it to soups and stews. Even its infamously bizarre and divisive flavor became a part of the brand's identity, with Marmite adopting the cheeky slogan, "Love it or hate it," as part of a 1996 advertising campaign. Indeed, over the years, Marmite has become a popular byword for an acquired taste, or a person, group, or anything else that divides public opinion. Yet this divisiveness did not stop Marmite from becoming popular across the British Commonwealth or from inspiring similar products including Synovus in Switzerland, Senovit in Brazil, Condibe in Argentina, Varn Dox in France, Guinness Yeast Extract in Ireland, Vitamin R in Germany, and of course Vegemite in Australia. And yes, after nearly 3,500 words, we finally got into the main topic of this video. We're sorry, but thank you. Thank you for still being here. What can we say? Love it, I hate it. History's complicated. Vegemite was created in the early 1920s by Fred Walker and Company, a food canning and import-export firm based in Melbourne. Founded in 1908 by the eponymous Fred Walker, in 1910 the company began canning meats, butter and cheese for export to Asia, South Africa and the UK, while in 1918 they introduced Bonox, a beef extract similar to Oxo and Bovril. In 1919, however, disruption of global trade caused by the First World War led to a severe slump in food imports and exports and shortages of various products, including Marmite. This prompted company founder and chairman Fred Walker to task chemist Cyril Callister with developing an indigenous alternative. Callister sourced leftover yeast from a nearby brewery, Carlton & United, and processed it using Justus von Liebig's autolysis method and blended the resulting product with salt, celery and onion extracts and caramel coloring to produce a sticky dark brown paste similar to Marmite but with its own distinct flavor profile. Walker & Co. ran a contest to name the new spread, offering a prize of $50 Australian, the equivalent of about $4,500 US today. In the end, the name Vegemite was selected by Walker's daughter, Sheila. Vegemite first hit Australian store shelves in 1923, with Walker & Co.'s advertising emphasizing the product's healthful virtues, especially for growing children. However, the product failed to take off at first, especially as the resumption of global trade brought increased competition from the already well-established Marmite brand. In desperation, in 1928, the company changed the name of the product from Vegemite to Parwil, solely so they could use the atrociously punny advertising slogan, Marmite, but Parwil. Shockingly, this brilliant wordplay failed to sway consumers, and in 1935, the extract's name was switched back to Vegemite. With sales still lagging far behind those of Marmite, the story of Vegemite might have ended there, were it not for a wise business decision made nearly a decade before. In 1926, Fred Walker partnered with Kraft Foods, Inc. to form the Kraft Walker Cheese Company, an Australian subsidiary focused on manufacturing and exporting processed cheese. This venture was highly successful and helped carry Fred Walker & Co. through its financial difficulties in the 20s and 30s. In 1935, the same year the ill-fated Parwil brand was switched back to Vegemite, Fred Walker died, and his company was wholly acquired by Kraft Foods, Inc., later Mondelez International. Kraft used its considerable marketing resources to heavily promote Vegemite, giving away free samples with Kraft Walker cheese products and funding poetry contests and other promotional events. As with Marmite, sales received a huge boost in 1939 when the British Medical Association officially endorsed Vegemite as a rich source of B vitamins. And during the Second World War, University of Adelaide physiologist Cedric Hicks recommended that Vegemite be rationed at home so it could be supplied to Australian troops, a fact heavily promoted in the company's advertisements. Quoting here, Vegemite fights with the men up north. If you are one of those who don't need Vegemite medicinally, then thousands of invalids are asking you to deny yourself of it for the time being. End quote. And when the troops came home, they brought their newly acquired taste for Vegemite with them, such that by the late 1940s, Vegemite was found in nearly 90% of Australian households. Throughout the post-war period, Kraft Walker's advertising continued to focus on Vegemite's health benefits for children, with a beloved advertising campaign created by J. Walter Thompson Advertising featuring healthy, happy children singing a now classic jingle. We're happy little Vegemites, as bright can be. We all enjoy our Vegemite for breakfast, lunch, and tea. Our mummies say we're growing stronger every single week because we love our Vegemite. We all adore our Vegemite. It puts a rose in every cheek. This jingle was first broadcast on the radio in 1954 and adapted for television in 1956. After running continuously for nearly a decade, the ad was retired and replaced by a new campaign featuring the now equally iconic slogan, Pass the Vegemite, please, Mum. In April 1984, the brand made retail history when a 115-gram container of Vegemite became the first product to be electronically scanned in an Australian supermarket, the transaction taking place at a Woolworths in Chullora, New South Wales, and costing 55 Australian cents. 2 years later, the original 1956 Happy Little Vegemites ad was partially colorized and rebroadcast, and once again it proved highly successful, running until 1991. Finally, in 2023, a new group of happy little Vegemites was cast alongside 71-year-old Trush Kavanagh, the original baton-twirling girl from the television ad, ensuring that the beloved jingle will continue to rattle around Australians' heads for generations to come. More than 100 years after its introduction, Vegemite remains an inextricable part of Australian culture, with Bega Cheese, the brand's current owner since 2017, churning out some 22 million jars, and Aussies consuming some 1.2 billion servings of the stuff every year. In October 2008, the 1 billionth jar of Vegemite rolled off the Bega production line in Melbourne. As Jamie Callister, grandson of Vegemite inventor Cyril Callister, said in an interview, quote, "It's part of our DNA. It's something I grew up with and was just always there. It's become a badge of honor for Australians, whether they are a fan of it or not." Indeed, the brand has expanded significantly since its introduction, with Vegemite finding its way into all sorts of products, including popular snacks like Arnott's Shapes crackers, sausages, chocolate in a biscuit, and Smith's crisps, sausages and meat pies, chocolate and smoothies, yes really, Vegemite singles flavored processed cheese slices, and Vegemite Cheesy Bite, a cream cheese Vegemite combination first introduced in 2009 and originally given the very 2000s name iSnack 2.0, before customer backlash forced a change. It has also spawned several imitators, including Chromite, introduced in the 1950s by Henry Lewis and Company and now owned by Mars Incorporated, and Aussiemite, launched in 2001. A version of Marmite has also been produced by the New Zealand Sanitarium Health and Wellbeing Company since 1919. Thus, the original British product is marketed as Armate in Australasia and Enzymite in the rest of the world. These products differ slightly in composition and flavor, with the New Zealand Marmite in particular incorporating large amounts of sugar. But the Australian original, whether spread on sandwiches and toast or mixed into stews and other recipes, remains by far the most popular in the region, and with good reason. Vegemite is extremely nutritious, with one serving containing 0.5 milligrams of vitamin B1, 0.43 milligrams of B2, 2.5 of B3, and 0.1 milligrams of folate. It is also certified vegan, kosher, and halal, meaning it can be eaten by just about everybody. Yet despite their beloved status, Vegemite and its Eastly cousins have not been without controversies. For instance, in 2006, the Australian media reported that Vegemite had been banned in the United States and that United States Customs Service agents had been instructed to search the luggage of Australian visitors for the foreign black goop. This, however, turned out to be little more than an urban legend, with the United States Customs and Border Protection issuing an official statement that no such ban had been implemented. But in 2001, much to the consternation of Commonwealth expats, Denmark did ban the import of foods fortified with additional vitamins, a category which includes Vegemite and Marmite. That same year, structural damage inflicted by the February 22nd Christchurch earthquake forced the New Zealand Marmite factory to shut down production for nearly 2 years, leading to widespread shortages and panic buying that news outlets amusingly named Marmageddon. On a more serious note, in 2015 it was reported that Vegemite, Marmite, and similar yeast spreads were banned in Australian prisons and that similar bans were being considered for dry Aboriginal communities in the outback, allegedly since these products could be used to illicitly brew alcohol. However, this assertion was quickly shown to be false, with Dr. Ben Scholes of the University of Queensland explaining in an interview, "The rationale for that previously was that Vegemite was a good source of yeast, and you needed yeast to ferment the sugar and turn that into alcohol. But we've shown that there is nothing that is alive in Vegemite. Indeed, the Vegemite is a really good nutrient source. It is a really good food source for the yeast. So, if you have the sugar for them to ferment, Vegemite to give the yeast extra food, then any yeast that is around will ferment pretty effectively, but you need the yeast." As a result, no such bans have been implemented outside of Britain's infamous Dartmoor prison, with then Australian Liberal Party leader and leader of the opposition Tony Abbott stating, "This is a deregulatory government, and the last thing I want to do is have a Vegemite watch, because Vegemite, quite properly, is for most people a reasonably nutritious spread on your morning toast or on your sandwiches." So take comfort, all you Aussies, or Aussies at heart, love it or hate it, Vegemite is here to stay. Cheers, mates.